I am going to talk a little bit about racial justice as it relates to housing, racial equity as it relates to housing. So I'm going to call it my presentation because some of the stats are pretty specific and it helps me kind of make sure I'm getting the numbers all right throughout it. So I appreciate your patience as I pull that up. And I think we're going to pull up a PowerPoint over there as well. So just give me a second here and I will get that going. But while I'm doing that, I am going to talk just a little bit about how this presentation kind of came about. Right as the pandemic was kind of starting, I got to the point where I was starting to read a little bit more about racial equity as it relates to housing, and I was actually invited to a Zoom presentation in regards to the Black Realtors Association on the south side of Chicago. And they put together some statistics in regards to how redlining, how some of the discrimination that occurred through banks had kind of not allowed that area to develop maybe as quickly as others, and what the systematic racism caused that area to be depressed and held back. So I said, well, that's very interesting, but I'm Habitat for Humanity of Champaign County. I want to kind of figure out what that looks like here locally, what that means. And with that, it also came about that I happened to talk to my board about it, talk to the United Way about it, and was able to take some time and do some research to kind of put some numbers to it, following kind of the baseline of what the presentation I saw in Chicago was. So luckily I was able to do that, and of course now I'm having trouble calling up my presentation. So that said, I think I can probably talk to this. Let me give it one more shot as I keep talking. But why Habitat as well, I think is a question I heard at the very beginning of this. Well, kind of racial justice has always been a part of Habitat's lifeblood. When it was started in 1942, it was about living together regardless of race in a community. They formed a farm, they were selling their products locally, very successful. But by 1950, times had started to transition a little bit more opposition to what they were doing. And by 1950, all the members of that group were excommunicated from their churches. By 1956, all the products they had been selling, what helped the farm go and be prosperous, were boycotted everywhere locally. So they didn't have a place to sell and have outputs that allowed the community to continue. Fortunately, 1957, the founder of that farm was Clarence Jordan. He received a letter of support from Martin Luther King Jr. That helped the farm be able to sell their products elsewhere regionally and a little further out and helped the farm sustain. By 1968, the founder of Habitat had come there, saw how successful it was, decided there was a need for housing for people moving into the community, but also outside of the community as well, and realizing this was a big thing to help people move forward. So in 1968, Clarence Jordan, or Millard Fuller and Linda Fuller arrived at the farm which Clarence Jordan had started, and they built the first partnership house in 1969 with volunteers. So Habitat was born. 1 year later, a house was built. All starting with racial justice and racial equality being a piece of it. Kind of flip to the Habitat locally mission. So by 1991, a group of community members had come together here locally. They were concerned about racial injustice in Champaign County. It was a large meeting. Many topics were discussed. Many things came out of that meeting, but one of the big things was Habitat was formed out of that meeting. By 1992, much like the international model, we built our first house. And by 1993, we had formed our student chapter at the U of I campus, which is still a big piece of what Habitat does. Down to the 2022, I won't kind of touch on the other things this morning, but we've now built 124 homes, so I need to update that. But over 90% of the homes we've built are minority owned. So that's always been a big piece of what we've done. Kind of the one exception to that is when the tornado went through Gifford. We did build a lot of houses in Gifford at that time and supported that community. So if we want to kind of go to the next one, there is a little bit of historical description, a little bit of a fun presentation as well. I saw this and it's been used in some other housing presentation. It's the Adam Ruins Everything. If you want to click on that, we're going to watch that. It's about 6 minutes. But he explains redlining, the history of it, in a better way than I can, and it's definitely a little more entertaining. If we can, I can talk to it. The top one, not the bottom one.
All right.
If we can get that. Yep, there it is.
Just over 150 years ago,
This
that's the longer one.
For almost
we
half
probably want
America.
To pause that one, if we can.
On multiple bills were people picking cotton. Enslaved people. These slaves didn't just represent...
Can you close out of that one? That's the...
They were wealth. By 18...
Yeah, that's a longer one. You guys probably don't want to hear me talk that long. yeah, this one, please. If we can.
Bad example. Ignore sweater dog people. A tote
bag
full of
camp. Just let it play.
You're killing me, lady.
You can expand
okay,
it.
Maybe this neighborhood is mostly too, completely too insufferably white. But it's just the way things are here. It doesn't mean we're racist.
I'm sure you're not, Ron, but the fact that so many suburbs are mostly white is no accident. It's the result of decades of racist federal policy that affect us to this day. Look!
Hooray, games!
What the heck kind of game is this?
It's Settlers of the Suburbs, Redlining Edition.
Cool!
Little Donovan, you be green. Ron, you're red.
All right, red, just like the name. Looks like I've got the advantage.
No, you don't. See, in the 1930s, as part of the New Deal, FDR created loan programs to help Americans finance their homes. But to decide who got those loans, the government created color-coded maps in which green neighborhoods were good and red neighborhoods were bad. This practice became known as redlining. Because of these policies, if you lived in the green neighborhoods, it was super easy to get a home loan. But for folks in the red areas, no loans were available.
I can barely afford rent with this. There's no fair. The red areas are screwed.
Yeah, they were. And do you know why some areas were designated as red?
No, but I can guess.
Those were the neighborhoods where African Americans and other minorities lived, and redlining systematically prevented them from getting home loans.
Well, I know what I'll do. Just take my little guy and put him in the green neighborhood.
Sorry, that's against the rules. Early suburb developers like William Levitt instituted explicitly racist policies.
Levittown homes must not be used or occupied by any person other than members of the Caucasian race.
And the federal government itself encouraged developers to discriminate.
Developers, I want you to exclude non-whites.
The result of these policies is that from 1934 through 1968, a whopping 98% of home loans were given to white families.
Yes! Okay, this is not fair. I did not get to pick what color I was when I started.
Yeah, no one does. And this advantage compounded over time. The families in the green or white neighborhoods were able to purchase homes and accrue wealth.
The market went up. I can sell my house and buy a bigger one.
Whereas the people in the red neighborhoods got none of those opportunities.
I can't afford property. I'm behind on my electric bill.
In the green neighborhoods, the influx of new wealth attracted new businesses.
Whoa, we got an organic grocery.
Which caused property values to go up. Which meant white families could sell their homes and send their kids to college.
They grow up so fast.
Passing down their wealth and advantages to future generations. Meanwhile, the red neighborhoods had far less ability to build wealth, and many remained trapped in poverty.
This game is rigged.
Yeah, it was. That's why laws were eventually passed that made most of these discriminatory practices illegal.
Great! Finally, I can move. I don't have enough money.
Exactly. Without wealth, families in the red neighborhoods couldn't afford to move up, keeping these communities separated by race. Today, 70 years after Levittown was created, it's still less than 1% black.
I may be dead, but the effect of my racism lives on.
And if the neighborhoods are segregated, that means the schools are, too.
What? No, that can't be true. We ended school segregation back in the 60s.
Sorry, Ron, but I'm afraid that's not true.
Ron, this is Nicole Hannah Jones. She's a New York Times investigative reporter who covers civil rights issues, including school and housing segregation. Nicole, would you mind telling Ron what most people get wrong about segregation?
People tend to think of segregation as an archaic term for Jim Crow policies that led to the civil rights movement. But the truth is that black children are more segregated in schools now than at any time since the 1970s.
And in the U.S., schools are largely funded by property taxes. Since property values in the white neighborhoods are so much higher, their schools get way more money to spend on things like facilities, teachers, and supplies.
On the other hand, predominantly black and Latino schools are massively underfunded. They're less likely to have AP, science, and math courses, and they're the least likely to have experienced and qualified teachers.
The truth is, Phil Donovan doesn't just go to the best school, he goes to a segregated school.
No.
This is a direct result of decades of redlining policies enacted by our own government to build the suburbs. Highways that were built to make access to the suburbs easier for white Americans were often run right through black middle-class neighborhoods, destroying them.
People in the past were the worst.
Not just the past. Banks still regularly charge black homebuyers higher rates on loans than they do white homebuyers, even when they have the same credit. Worst of all, black and Latino home seekers still experience 4 million incidents of illegal housing discrimination every year.
But, I mean, I didn't do any of that stuff. I'm not racist, and I worked hard to get this house.
Of course, but without realizing it, you've also gotten a leg up from America's history of racist housing policies. The suburb you live in was built on a foundation of segregation, and we can't close our eyes to that.
You can stop it there. So again, kind of bringing that back to Champaign County, on the next slide, it talks about early segregation and what existed here. There were racially restrictive covenants in 1941 through 1950 on the books. It was very clear in terms of the subdivisions that were developed during those times. The covenants were all worded exactly the same way. And I read it because it's so powerful to me and makes me continue to think and realize the systematic discrimination that occurred. But it's no part thereof will be sold or leased either in whole or in part to or permitted to be occupied as owner or tenant by any person or persons not of the Caucasian race. On the books right here in Champaign County. Additionally, in 1951, there was public housing units built, 140 in fact, 70 for white households, 70 for African American families. The Champaign project was called Birch Court. It was a new mixed income development. Now it's a mixed income development renamed Douglas Square. The cost of the Champaign projects was $1.47 million, but only 21% went towards the black households, black homes being built, whereas 80% of it basically went to the white household. So even when it looks equal, the dollars spent were not equal. By 1965, it was obviously becoming more of an issue even on campus to ensure there was not discrimination in housing. 52% of the spaces in uncertified homes and 80% of the apartments that were offered to students through the housing division were not allowed to be listed because the operator's failure to sign the clause of non-discrimination. So these things were even happening in and around the campus area. So one of my favorite quotes is, history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. So obviously the history does somewhat predict what's going to happen into the future. So how is segregation here today? So if we click on the next one, it talks about Springfield and Champaign-Urbana, one of the latest studies in Governing Magazine. We are more segregated in Champaign-Urbana area than Charlottesville, Virginia, and the Daphne area of Mobile, Alabama. This kind of shocked me as I continued to do this research, because I always thought segregation was something a little more southern and not in central Illinois. Knew there was concerns, obviously, but that we were, one of the more segregated areas in the country. You can see Peoria here is the sixth most racially divided metro area. It's kind of the city that's always held up as if it plays in Peoria, it plays in the rest of America. So to know that is concerning as well. And when it comes to school, Peoria is considered the most segregated school in the nation. So this is not unique to Champaign-Urbana, but central Illinois cities as a whole. How does this relate to housing specifically and population? So in the state of Illinois, black households make up 15% of the population, but only receive 7% of new mortgages. Additionally, the black mortgage denial rate is 30%, whereas in the state of Illinois, the denial rate for mortgage applications is 16%. In terms of the population as a whole, 62% of white households own 75% of the mortgages. So Champaign County, any better than the state of Illinois, south side of Chicago? I found out we're actually comparable in a lot of ways. So here in Champaign County, black households make up that 12% of the population here, but only own 6% of the homes. Whereas white households in Champaign County make up 72% of the population, but own 84% of the homes. Just in terms of the home ownership rate on the next slide, white households own homes at a 62% rate, black households own homes at a 28% rate. When we talk about home ownership at Habitat specifically, when there's a medical emergency, when children need sent to college, when there's an unexpected accident, anything to that extent, home ownership gives you that ability, that opportunity to have something to fall back on, something to have equity in to overcome some of those concerns. Without the ownership, it definitely becomes an even bigger challenge. So the loan application rate, in terms of our county specifically, we talked about potential black homeowners being 12% of the population, but they're only turning in 6% of applications that exist in our county. And then remember, the denial rate is pretty high, and I'll go to that on the next slide, but the white percentage of the population is 72%, but they're turning in 86% of the applications. The rejection rate is even more troubling in my mind. White households are denied at a 20% rate, but black households are denied at a much higher 33% rate when they apply for mortgages here in Champaign County. And this is 2020 data, not 20 years ago, not 10 years ago, recently. So kind of going on to the next one, a little bit more of when approved, black households are approved at a 13% lower value. So the wealth they want to build, the resale value of homes, is also impacted even once approved through the banking process and mortgage process. As you can see, I didn't talk too much about Asian population, but just to show another minority in our county, $180,000 average value of Asian families are approved for, and white families are right in that same ballpark. So how does that compare? Like, what do we do now with home prices as well? We realize that black families are approved at a lower rate. They don't have as many funds to invest in a home because of that, but the prices of lower cost homes are escalating much more quickly than higher priced homes. Nationally especially, that's been the case, but it's also the case locally. And the price of homes is not raising nearly as quickly as the price or the income that people earn, especially for low to moderate incomes. So it's even harder to afford a house than it was, 10 to 20 years ago. Kind of the last point on that, new home constructions, less than 1,800 square feet. An 1,800 square foot home is pretty large. Habitat builds 1,300 to 1,500 square foot homes as opening entry-level homes. So anything under 1,800 square feet, only 24% of homes were built at that level. I can tell you in Champaign County, the only organization right now building homes for ownership of families in the 1,300 to 1,400 square foot kind of space is Habitat. There's nobody else who's doing that now. So even if you are trying to purchase an entry-level home, it's very difficult to do so because there's not enough on the market. If we go to the next one, this is Champaign over the last 3 years, up through 2022. 18% increase in home prices. I can guarantee low and moderate incomes have not went up across the board 18%. In fact, no, I have stats that prove that. So just becoming more and more unaffordable to purchase your first home. I'd be remiss if I didn't talk a little bit about COVID. Delinquencies across across a few of the selected groups. White households are delinquent at about a 7 to 8% rate. White, Hispanic, and Asian are all over the 15% rate in terms of delinquencies. This is about a year and a half old now. So obviously, if those delinquencies turn into foreclosures, into evictions, that percentage of home ownership rate is going to be even wider as years progress. So this has come down a little bit, to be honest. So that's improved a bit in terms of delinquencies over the last year and a half. why home ownership? What's the key? The number one thing to protect wealth in future, into the future, is home ownership. If you own a home, you have the ability to accumulate wealth. That's the number one predictor, and the experts agree on that. In the last 10 years, the gap between low and high income households grew. I don't think that's necessarily a surprise to many. We've heard talk of the shrinking middle class. That's kind of what this is saying. But the median incomes for black and white households grew, but black household incomes rose much more slowly in absolute terms. So the income gap is actually wider than it has been in decades. The median income for black households in 2019 was just over $43,000, and the median income for white households was $71,000, just about. What does it mean in terms of wealth, though, accumulation? Even more stark, 2019, the white households held $188,200 in wealth, almost eight times as the typical black household. That's really because of home ownership. That's the biggest attributor to that as well in terms of what they've recognized. So I think what I found and kind of came to some conclusions on myself is where I thought, and Champaign is a wonderful community, a very giving community, a very progressive community in terms of rentals and minority placement and immigration and things. We are ahead of the curve. There are some statistics there that prove that. In terms of home ownership, we have some work to do here in our county for sure. Why we talk about home ownership, obviously at a wealth equity or wealth inequality and closing that, home ownership is a big piece of that. Also, the benefits to the community are huge in terms of home ownership, in terms of children being less likely to have interactions with law enforcement, less likely to be teen parents, significantly more likely to attend and graduate from college. Same thing with high school, to graduate on time. So the impact of home ownership is great. And I think it's one thing that helps as we continue on this journey of racial equity. So that's kind of my talk for today. I don't know if you guys do questions or that's something after the service, but
I don't know.
Where'd Renee go? Right down front.
Yeah, we have time for a couple questions.
Questions if people want. I'm happy to. Yes.
I'm guessing you're aware of the tiny homes village that's about to be constructed in Urbana. It's my understanding those are not homes for ownership per se, but I'm just kind of wondering how you feel about, how is that going to help? I think the idea is there that they're trying to help people to get prepared for home ownership. And what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think those tiny homes can be a step on the spectrum of going from homelessness to actually having a stable place. I'm kind of curious, some other markets have done that, some other cities, and it's been a mixed result. So I think if done appropriately and correctly, I think it can help. And we do have a homelessness issue here or a opportunity to improve that. And I think this is another way to kind of tackle that. I'll be interested to see how that kind of moves forward and as people move through that kind of process. But I think it has potential. I like the idea. So predominantly of the 124 homes we've built, the largest percentage is in Champaign-Urbana. Most of them are in the Urbana neighborhood behind Carl Hospital. But we also have about 40% of our houses in Champaign. We have some in Rantoul. We have built outside of that too, and we're building in Rantoul, Urbana in the spring, and we're finishing up two Urbana houses right now from the fall that will be done quickly. So each city is a little different. We try to get all the lots donated. So Rantoul and Urbana are donated. Champaign, we have to kind of bid in an open RFP process for the lots. But the cities have all been really good about clearing the lots completely, getting the foundations out, clearing trees, not real good trees like the scrub trees, but that keeps the cost down for us to then put the house on them. So if we get a lot that's donated without all that done, it's almost too expensive for us to build. So that's a big blessing when that happens.
Yeah, I have a question. I go around town, and there are some beautiful homes over there in the market Those are for the black people, or are they for everybody?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite.
Market and Bradley.
Oh, the new development there. Yeah, those are Housing Authority houses that was built. That's been a wonderful development. Those are for rental with the opportunity to purchase in 20 years. Habitat's a much quicker model in terms of ownership, and we think that creates more buy-in to have such a quick turnaround. 20 years is a long time to commit to eventually own a home.
I have a question. Weren't those homes built for the black people?
So the Bristol Place was built for individuals who had a need for housing, who were looking for assistance. I don't think there was any restriction, and there wouldn't be any restriction in terms of who they were for. So.
And there's also a lot of nice new homes over on Lincoln. There's some on Lincoln, and then there's also some.
We probably have time for one more question by somebody else who hasn't asked. Is there anybody else who has a question for Chad? And he will be able to say something probably afterwards if you have more questions.
Yeah, I'm happy to stay after and talk for a little bit if anybody has other questions.
What's the cost in materials for Habitat House?
Yeah, that's been a big challenge for us with COVID. 30% increase, honestly, in housing costs. Usually, we were around $115,000 actually to build a house, depending how much is donated, and we do have a lot of support on that front. But we're probably up $30,000 on that right now. So it's not cheap to build housing. That is never the case. So I wish it was more reasonable.
Another question: how many houses about do you build per year?
Yeah, we try to build 5 to 6 a year. We were able to do 4 kind of through the pandemic, and now that we've relocated, we have a retail shop called The Restore that's really designed to help fund our housing mission because it is so expensive to build. So that's a big piece of what we do, and then we do look for support obviously elsewhere too.
And then my last question, what's the limiting thing? Why only 4 to 6 houses? Is it funding? Is it personnel? What is keeping you from doing more?
So yeah, I think for us, we could build 6 to 10 pretty easily with our existing staff. It is funding that holds us back from building that many on a yearly basis. For each opening, when we open up our application process for homeowners, we're accepting 4 to 5 families per year. We usually get typically 100 applications for that process. And Habitat is a hand up, not a hand out, so it is a 0% mortgage at the end of the home build. The home isn't given away. So the opportunity to partner with us is huge, but we know there's so much more need out there and people who want to own a home and have that pride in being part of their neighborhood. So we want to help more, and we're continuing to try to grow what we can do to help more people.
All right, thanks. Jeff, you come back.